So tonight, we're going to talk about a body of law that has lots and lots and lots of complications, and we're going to avoid most of them. On the other hand, we can't avoid the topic entirely. We've talked a little about it, actually, because we talked about conditions in the context of consideration. Remember when we wondered whether or not the presence of a condition would destroy consideration. We did it in the case of Scott versus Morgan Lumber Company. If I buy a boat, I'll charter it to you. And we asked the question of whether or not we said that if I buy the boat is a condition, and that if the condition is not satisfied, it means that the obligor does not have to charter a boat. And we wondered, does that destroy the presence of consideration? And we decided, or the courts have decided, that it did not. Although there is obviously some disagreement about whether or not we should describe that as a contract that has not been breached in the event that the boat is not purchased, or we should describe it as a contract which exists, but the obligation to charter has never matured because the boat has not been purchased. And when the boat is purchased, the obligation matures. Or some courts would say, when the boat is actually purchased, at that point, it is binding. Whichever way you say it involves some jurisprudential difficulties in explaining why it's the case. We tried, just to refresh your recollection, I tried to do it by saying that even the expression, if I buy the boat, I'll charter it to you, if we imagined that that were binding, it would mean at least this much, that he's given up the opportunity to buy a boat and use it for anything else other than chartering it to the promisee. And so the consideration is to be found in that limitation on what otherwise would be his freedom of action. So we had a little introduction to conditions, and now we come back and look at it again and see that there is a kind of oddity about condition, particularly now when we compare it to the treatment of the courts of, quote, substantial performance, the subject we talked about in last class. Because it now tells us that, at least for some contracts, many contracts, that the court will look at the amount of effort, the amount of accomplishment of the promisor, and if it's nearly everything that they were supposed to do, that it is probable that the court will decide that while they've breached, that breach does not excuse the other party from performing. It only gives the other party a right to sue for damages, if any, that they suffered by reason of the breach. So that we saw that in the construction case, if the contractor did almost everything they were supposed to do, and they left just a few things undone that were not particularly significant in terms of the overall value of the job, that the court is likely to say the defendant is not excused from the obligation of the contract. In the case of the pipe that was not of the proper origin, the court said that the owner still had to make that last payment under the contract that he had promised to make, even though the contractor had not performed perfectly. He would have a right of action against the contractor for breach of contract, but he couldn't withhold his own performance on the theory that the contractor had breached. We turn to conditions. We see the courts looking at conditions in an entirely different way. The courts have said that if it's a condition, the condition has to be perfectly satisfied. We don't use the word performed in connection with a condition. We use the word whether or not the condition has been satisfied or not. And there's no such thing as a partial satisfaction, at least in the initial concept of conditions, of express conditions. So that if I said, for example, that if it rains more than 1.1 inches between the hours of 9 and 12 tomorrow morning, I will deliver to you a pair of rain boots for which you will pay me $25. Well, if it rains 1/10 of an inch less than that, well, the condition is almost satisfied, but no, it's not so. Because it's a condition, and it's express condition, it has to be totally satisfied, completely satisfied. It has to be at least that, whatever, 1.1. So there are lots of questions that raises right away. Because now life was hard enough when we had contracts and we had promises, and then we had to distinguish between whether the promise was performed or substantially performed or not. But now we learn that there's something else that you can have in a contract, and that's called an express condition, and it's treated entirely differently. We'll never really quite get to the bottom of what created this bifurcation of the notions of what can be in a contract. Why it is that instead of there being promises and conditions, why can't there just be promises? The nearest you can get to it is to think about those cases in which one party did not want to be bound at all, did not want any obligations at all unless things were in a certain way. A little later on this evening, we're going to talk about a person buying stock in another company whose only asset was real property. And they didn't want to own the stock unless there was title insurance on the property. Title insurance assures that the person who claims to be the owner really is the owner. And if they're not, there's a claim against an insurance company to make up for whatever losses may occur because, in fact, they were not the owners. Now, we could, of course, say, well, you have to promise me that you were the owner. But you see, that's not a way of avoiding the risk. And they don't want to go into this deal at all unless they see the title insurance. And so that's an example of an instance in which, all right, they do want a condition. Now, interestingly enough, they may also want a promise. That is, they may want the seller, the owner of the corporation whose stock they're buying, they may want them to promise to buy title insurance. If they wrote, I promise to buy title insurance, that would be a promise. If the promise were breached, there would be a right of action if any damages flowed from their failure to perform the promise. Or, in the alternative, we could say there is an express condition that you get insurance. If you do not get title insurance, I am under no obligation to buy the stock. I haven't asked under those circumstances that a promise be made to acquire title insurance. I've simply said that if there is no title insurance in its absence, I will not be obliged to buy it. So you can see from a business point of view, they really accomplish different things. The law allows them to accomplish both in the same contract. That is, I could write the contract saying that the seller of stock, the owner of the property, promises to acquire title insurance. And I could also write in a condition saying that if you do not buy the title insurance, then I have no obligations to buy. Among other things, that gives me a choice. If I wanted, I could waive the condition and go ahead and buy the stock and then bring an action against the seller of the stock for whatever damages I may suffer because of the absence of title insurance. That, of course, would only happen if somebody else shows up and makes a claim against the title, which does happen. So they do different things. There is less clarity, probably, about the question of, well, why don't we apply the same doctrine of substantiality to conditions? Suppose that it's just the most minor deviation from the condition, the tenth of an inch in rainfall. Why is it that the courts traditionally said, oh, no, no, the idea of substantiality, that doesn't exist for conditions. It's satisfaction or not. Like circles, they're round or they're not circles. Well, we went on for a couple hundred years with that view, but if you read these cases carefully, you know we don't really have that view anymore. But there are some circumstances in which the courts will continue to insist upon total satisfaction of a condition. And then again, there are some which they will not. So to understand that reluctance, we have to go back and think about the consequences of a determination that is an express condition and that it's not been satisfied. Well, it may be that nobody's done anything. You've made the contract, you wait, nobody commits themselves in any way to any other action, and then the condition is not satisfied, and the parties both walk away, frustrated by the failure to accomplish whatever the deal was, but nevertheless not having lost anything either, other than an expectation or a hope of profit. But that's not the only thing that can happen. And we'll see that there are circumstances in which there can be a substantial, either some benefit to the person who now can walk away because the conditions have not been satisfied. Maybe they've gotten some kind of a benefit already from the beginning of performance. Or maybe the other side, the side who's about to lose out on the contract because the conditions have not been satisfied, maybe they have experienced legitimate and foreseeable reliance costs because everybody thought, both sides thought the contract was a go. After all, it had all the attributes of contract. There was consideration, there was mutual assent. It had to be in writing, it was in writing. And things begin to happen. People begin to spend money. Well, then courts say, well, wait a second. If this is an express condition, and if it's not been completely satisfied, there may be a, and they use the term, forfeiture. Forfeiture. What's the forfeiture? Well, in a specific case, if one side has begun to perform, the forfeiture means that they will lose whatever investment they've made in relying on the existence of the contract. That's a forfeiture. So the courts today, not surprisingly, minded as they are to worry about things like restitution for benefits that have not received but not paid for, worrying about reliance on the part of somebody who had reasonably expended some money because they believed that the contract was a go. Those sympathies exist in our jurisprudence in contracts and influence courts. But then the question is, well, what can you do? How can you be influenced against a precedent which says, oh, if it's an express condition, it has to be completely satisfied? That's really what we're going to look at. We're going to look at what courts do, if anything, when they're confronted with that particular kind of problem. So let's start. I asked you to read only a few of these many cases that are in the case book. Let's start with Oppenheimer versus, and Company versus Oppenheimer, Pell, Dixon and Company. That's on page 935. This is New York Court of Appeals in 1995. It's a relatively recent case. What was the express condition? I keep on saying it clearly, express condition, because on Thursday night we're going to look at cases where the courts talk about condition, but they're not express conditions. Express condition means that there's an articulation in the contract of the existence of a condition. So what was the condition in the Oppenheimer case? Remember, this involved a sublease arrangement?
Written consent to be received by February 25th. Written consent by February 25th.
Well, there were two, weren't they? Were there two conditions? Or three conditions? Conditions were fairly widely used in this particular agreement on both sides. They're only fighting about one of them. By the time we get to the Court of Appeals.
Well, the first one was that the plaintiff obtained prime landlord's written confirmation that defendant
okay.
is subtenant.
Yeah. The prime landlord, that's the top landlord because it's a lessee and sublessee. But the prime landlord has to give written consent. Written consent on a particular date, by a particular date. And then the date is extended, but it's by agreement of the parties, they modify it, but it's by a particular date. Okay. Was that the only condition in this agreement? What else was there?
Well, then there was a date for a plan for tenant work. The defendant was required to submit to plaintiff on or before January 2nd, a plan for tenant work.
Okay. So this was a case in which they, the tenant, had to provide plans for tenant work, whatever that was. Some, among other things, remember that they had already operated on the 30-something or another floor, and this was on the 29th floor, and they had to run communications line between the two because they were going to be operating on two different floors but operating as a single entity. And so there had to be some work done in order to compensate for the fact that they didn't want to run up and down three flights of steps every time they wanted to talk. What went wrong here? First of all, as far as we know, did the landlord, the prime landlord, give consent?
To the original sublet, yes. I mean, to the first condition, yes.
The first condition,
yes.
They did. What's the problem then?
The third condition was that the prime landlord had to give written approval of the tenant plan by a certain date, and they didn't get the written approval. The attorney for the other side gave an oral.
Okay. They had an oral consent, which they communicated on the deadline, on the very last day. How long, and then did they deliver the written consent?
They did, but it was like a month or something.
Yeah, a month later, right? A month later, they delivered the written consent. Now, let's keep in mind that, be honest about this. On the one hand, was consent important? Would that be a material concern to this sublessee? Why?
Well, because I think the prime landlord has the overall say on whether or not they can do this work, and this work was important for them to operate.
Right, okay. Because ultimately, in the agreement between the landlord and the tenant, who was now the lessor, that had to be agreed on by the landlord. Without the landlord's consent, they could not, in fact, occupy this property. So this is very important to them. So they write it as an express condition. How do I know it's an express condition? What are the words in which it is articulated that make it an express condition?
If they didn't do it, that the contract is null and void?
Yeah. If they didn't do it, the contract is null and void. Now, there are other ways of saying it. Sometimes you actually say, on condition that, and my advice to you as a draftsperson is, that's the way you do it. You could also do it using the word unless. And if you like very short words, you can use if. But it's wise to use one of those. Now, they didn't hear, nevertheless, they made it clear that if this did not occur, then it would be void. And the court accepted that as an express condition. Well, notice this, that the reason it was not satisfied is not that the landlord didn't give consent. Not only was it communicated orally one time, but it was delivered actually in writing a month later. So there's no doubt about the fact that they had consented. Do you think that the reason that this tenant, subtenant, did not take this property was because of the absence of a written consent?
No.
Probably not. Probably not. Why else? They didn't want the deal. They changed their mind. Between the time they made it and the time to perform it, they changed their mind. It may be, of course, that when they drew up the plans for what had to be done, that they discovered the price was too high. I don't know. But for whatever reason, I think they just didn't want the deal anymore. Was there a forfeiture here? Is there a kind of loss to the other party, the party who is now finds that because the person who was benefited from the condition says the condition was not satisfied, which is true, it was not satisfied? What have they lost?
They didn't really lose anything in this case because the party who was the Y and Owen Y company, they agreed to indemnify any expenses they sustained from moving.
That's right. Yeah, in this particular case, there were none, so the court didn't have to worry about it. See, and if the court doesn't have to worry about it, then you find a favorable disposition on the part of the court to giving the express condition it full force. Full force. In addition to a condition, was it also a promise? What'd the promise be? The promise would be, I promise to obtain the signature of the landlord on a piece of paper, the prime landlord's piece of paper which says that this is kosher. Yeah.
I don't know if that could be a promise, though, because how could they make that happen? It's up to the landlord. So they can't.
They could promise it.
So
couldn't they? After all, Wedge-O-Matic promised the computer that it couldn't build. You can always promise things. On the other hand, you might say that if it's ambiguous, though, you would be inclined not to interpret it as they were promising it on the ground that it was something that they knew that they couldn't really deliver or that they might not be able to deliver. This is really noticed now a problem of interpretation. Indeed, in every conditioned case, there is a problem of interpretation. Think about the possibilities now. The language I'm looking at could be a promise. Just one of those old-fashioned things. They promise to do something, and all I have to do is decide have they performed the promise or substantially performed the promise. Or it could be an express condition, in which case I have to look to see whether or not the condition's been perfectly satisfied or not. Or it could be both a promise and a condition. This came up, if you remember, when we talked about the case of the drunken law professor, Clark versus West. And the court ultimately decides that's a condition. Now, they said it was a condition. In that case, saying it was a condition was actually a favorable ruling because the court then said, because it's a condition, it could be waived. It doesn't have the problem that a promise would have, because the promise would have to be modified, and to modify the promise, you'd have to have consideration, and there was no consideration coming from the law professor for that change. But by saying it's a condition can be waived, the court says, and waiver does not require consideration. So the court said it was a condition. But was it a promise as well? Was the professor promising to be sober when he wrote the book? Could be. Does it matter? Well, of course it does. Because there is at least the potential for suing for non-performance of a promise. You can't sue for non-satisfaction of a condition. If the condition is not satisfied, it's not satisfied, and the contract is over. But if a promise is not performed, well, that's a breach. And for a breach, there can be damages. So it could be a condition only express condition. It could be only a promise, and it could be both a promise and a condition. How do I figure that out? Contract interpretation. What words were used? What was the apparent intent of the parties? Depending upon the attitude of the court toward the parole evidence rule, what can I learn from hearing testimony about the discussions that the parties had prior to the drafting of the agreement? Can I look to see how they've been performing it? And by how they're performing it, will that inform me about what the parties thought that the language meant? Have they had a similar agreement in the past? And if so, how did they perform that? Does that show me what the language meant to them? And let's not forget, is this language regularly used in the trade? And if so, how does the trade understand it? Do they understand it as a condition or as a promise or both when this language is used in agreements in the trade? Those are all our rules of interpretation. They should all sound familiar to you. So those are the exercises that the court has to go through. So here they look at it and say, gee, this is an express condition. The question is the express condition satisfied? And the answer is no, the express condition has not been satisfied. Notice that the court below wanted to use the doctrine of substantial performance, and this court, the New York Court of Appeals, the top court in New York, says, no, it's an express condition. It has to be perfectly satisfied. There's no room for the doctrine of substantial performance here once we decide that it is a express condition. Let's look at Merritt Hill Vineyards. This is the case I referred to earlier. They were going to buy stock, but there was a, quote, condition precedent, they said. Now, there are two kinds of express conditions, just to make your life as a law student doubly difficult. There are conditions precedent and conditions subsequent. The good thing about the difference is that it makes a procedural difference, and therefore I could just hand the whole thing over to let Adamite worry about it rather than a substantive difference in contract law, because it makes a difference who pleads it. Is it in the complaint or is it in the answer? Who has to raise it? If a party is suing for breach of contract and the obligation of the defendant was subject to a condition, and it's a condition precedent, the plaintiff has to plead and ultimately prove the satisfaction of the condition, and therefore the obligation of the defendant. If, on the other hand, this is a case in which it is a condition subsequent, in condition subsequent, what happens is that the parties have obligations to perform and they begin their performance, but then they've agreed that if a certain event happens, then all obligations will cease. That's called a condition subsequent to at least the beginning of performance. Well, in that case, it would be the defendant who was arguing, yes, but there's a condition subsequent, and I was relieved of my obligations under the contract because the condition subsequent occurred. That has to be pleaded by the defendant in the answer rather than included by the plaintiff in the complaint. Otherwise, the two are exactly the same. There are the same rules about the expression. They have to be used in language like it is a condition unless so-and-so, if so-and-so occurs, and so on. So here, the agreement lists conditions precedent to which the obligation of purchaser to pay the purchase price complete the purchase is subject. Title insurance and some confirmation from the Farmers Home Administration that if they buy the stock, that will not be regarded by the Farmers Home Administration as a default on a mortgage which they undoubtedly insured. The Farmers Home Administration, we don't hear as much about these days, but it's just like the FHA, only it was for farmers. It grew up at the same era, as part of the recovery from the Great Depression, or what we used to think of, I think I'm going to say the first Great Depression. Well, here's the question, what do we do? What happened below? What was done at, quote, special term? This case, again, is Court of Appeals in New York, a little bit older, 1984, decade before the Oppenheimer case. What's the plaintiff won here?
Plaintiff wants their deposit return.
Yeah, they want their money back.
Yeah, $26,000 in consequential damages.
And they also want damages. They want their money back. The money was a deposit. They want that back. And they want consequential damages. And they move for summary judgment. Move for judgment that means, you know, pleadings and affidavits and stuff, and then they move for judgment without trial. And what happened in special term to their motion for summary judgment?
It was denied.
So under New York practice, unlike under federal practice, that's an appealable order. So they appeal to the App Division, the Appellate Division. And what does the Appellate Division do?
They granted it for the deposit, but denied it for the damages.
They grant summary judgment for the deposit. So what's the theory? What's their theory on the first step?
It was a material thing that they were asking for when they went in to get the title, and the confirmation of mortgage was a material condition. And by not doing that, they were within their right to.
Now, you've actually said two things, which is all right, except we have to see what they are.
Okay.
Because you used the word material. Was it an express condition?
Yes.
It was. Does it matter if an express condition is a material part of the agreement?
No. Well, I think some of the courts were looking at it as whether or not it was an inconsequential thing versus if it was a really big
It's exactly right. And we started out with a body of law that said, look, an express condition is an express condition. That was the law for hundreds of years. But now you notice the court begins to introduce another idea, the idea of the materiality of this express condition. Well, this was an easy case for that, right? Because there's no doubt about the fact that from the standpoint of the buyers of stock in a corporation whose sole asset is the farm, that it was material to them whether or not there's title insurance, and it was also material whether or not the Farmers Home Administration would say, hey, it's okay to buy it, it won't be a default. obviously the consequence of it being a default is suddenly the corporation in which they just bought stock has now got to come up with money to pay off the mortgage, which is important. What about the consequential damages? The court takes that, this appellate court thinks that's right to deny those. Why are they denied them? I mean, they kind of win, right? If you win on the express condition, then how come they can't get damages from the defendant?
Then there's no contract. Didn't they ended up not having the contract?
Because if it's an express condition, the express condition is not satisfied, the court says, we're finished. Now, would that be true if they had made a promise to get the title insurance?
If it's ruled as a promise, then they would have a right to go after damages.
Yeah. If the court said, hey, this is not only an express condition, but it's also a promise, then there might very well have been damages if they could show loss because they breached the promise. If, on the other hand, it is an express condition, well, and the express condition is not satisfied, the buyer does not have any obligation to buy, the seller has no right to retain the deposit, but they have no affirmative obligation that they've breached. Beginning to make some sense out of this pattern? I hope so. Let's look at the Howard case. 945 Howard versus Federal Crop Insurance Corporation. Wasn't me. Look at the language on page 946. And we have an interpretation issue, as we frequently have when we're dealing with the law of conditions. This is a what in the world is this kind of question. And I know that some of you will look at this and say, as a lousy government lawyer couldn't draft decently, and that would be right, this is not well drafted. But you know, it's easy to look at an agreement after you realize there's a problem and you know what the problem is and decide whether or not, and oh yeah, look how badly drafted it was. But on the other hand, I'm not so sure that you would have seen the problems in the draftsmanship before the event occurred. Maybe you would, maybe you wouldn't. Anyway, here we go. We have paragraph 5 of the tobacco endorsement. Since it's an insurance policy, everything's called endorsement. You probably know that from your own insurance. 5B. It shall be a condition preceding to the payment of any loss that the insured established the production of the insured crop on a unit, and that such loss has been directly caused by one or more of the hazards insured against during the insurance period for the crop year for which the cost is claimed, furnish any information that's required by the corporation. So this typical provision in an insurance policy, and notice that it is worded as what? Is it a condition or a promise? It's a condition. No doubt about what this is, it is a condition. From the standpoint of the insurance company, after all, if you don't provide them with the evidence, they don't care. I mean, it doesn't bother them. They don't want to promise from you to provide that information. They just want to make sure that they don't have to be paying insurance when you have not proved your loss. Fine, so we know why that's there. Perfectly logical to be there. 5F, so we're in the same paragraph, paragraph 5, but we're now several provisions down below it. The tobacco stalks on any acreage of tobacco of types 11A, 11B, 12, 13, or 14, with respect to which a loss is claimed, shall not be destroyed until the corporation makes an inspection. So you remember what happened here was, this crop is wiped out by storms. He digs in. He cuts the plants and then digs in the rest. And he digs it in before the inspector from the government shows up to inspect it, pursuant to 5F in response, obviously, to insurance claim that the farmers made. And I guess that the government had no argument about 5B, as that is that he provided evidence of what the size of the crop was and what his losses were and what caused the losses. But the government says, yeah, but you dug in the remains, therefore you didn't do what you had to do under 5F, and 5F is a condition precedent to our obligation to pay. Now, let's suppose that you're stuck with this language, right? So you're now in the United States Department of Justice, and you are now presenting this case, and you didn't draft it. Some lawyer for the Farmers Home Administration drafted it. What argument would you make in support of the position that the government wants to take, that this, in fact, is a condition, an express condition? You can't say it says on condition that, right? You don't have that. It doesn't say if or unless. So you don't have any of those easy keys, magic words, to argue express condition. Sure.
Well, could you go back to part 5B of the contract and say that, well, the insured has to produce information about the loss by cutting down the crops. They've made it impossible to get that information. So that condition can't occur.
Okay, so you try to build 5F, you try to have 5F as a part of 5B.
Yeah, or just fall completely on 5B and try to use that to say that.
Well, I think that they didn't succeed in doing that, because after all 5B says is he has to establish the production of the insured crop and that it was caused by one or more of the hazards. Well, this is a publicly visible hazard, right? This is part of the United States climatological report, so they know exactly what happened. And the production of the insured crop is something he has the capacity to prove. He can prove how much he seeded. He probably has a federal official in the area that's probably looked at the crops. I mean, so the precise thing that you have to show, in order to do what you want to do, you'd have to argue that in order to understand what kind of evidence 5B had in mind, it incorporates 5F, but unfortunately, you don't even have an internal reference in 5B to 5F, which you would really like to have. So I don't know that you're going to get very far with that argument. Okay.
Well, in 5F, it does say it shall not be destroyed until the corporation makes an inspection.
Okay, the word until is there, although it's not tied exactly into the obligation of the insurance, of the federal government insurance agency. But what you're going to say is, well, look, it says it shall not be destroyed until the corporation makes an inspection, so that's language which suggests that it is a condition. That is, that what they were trying to say is that in terms of the behavior of the farmer's behavior has to be this. They have to leave it intact. They can't destroy any evidence of what the crop, the ruined crop, looked like. How did the court argue it? They came obviously to the opposite conclusion. How did they argue it? Because they clearly didn't accept that kind of argument.
They said the lack of the word condition made it, they used a kind of a deductive, like, if it was supposed to be conditioned, it would have also included the word.
Okay. See, here's the problem. And this, notice that this argument is only available because of the language of 5B. So it's 5B ends up impairing the argument that you'd otherwise like to make, and I think you were making it in 5F. Because the court says, well, wait a second. They knew exactly how to say something is an express condition. Look, they did it in 5B. When they got to 5F, they didn't use that language. Therefore, they did not intend to create an express condition. Now, there's another way of talking about this case, and many courts would, and that is to say, look, it's not, you can say about 5F that there's some language which suggests condition, like I said. You can. But you know something? It's not unambiguous. It could mean that, or it could only mean that the farmer is being instructed by the policy to kind of leave it alone until it's inspected. And if they don't leave it alone until it's inspected, and if that costs the government extra money, let's say they now have to bring out some sort of a forensic agriculture expert to determine whether or not it really was the storm that killed the crops or whether it was some other uninsured harm that had occurred. If that costs extra money, well, then the farmer's breached. That is, that this is really a promise by the farmer, that the farmer will not dig under the crops until after the inspector has looked at it. And if they breached it, well, they're liable if damages can be proved, but the government still has to pay for the insurance, provided that the express condition in 5B has been satisfied. So the rule, and this goes all the way back now to restatement first, is, look, if it's ambiguous, construe it as a promise. Why? I mean, the rule could be, if it's ambiguous, construe it as a condition. What this is telling you is conditions aren't favored, promises are. And the reason conditions aren't favored is that they're so damned inflexible. Has to be completely satisfied. That is the traditional notion of express condition. It is extremely inflexible. It gives the courts very little room for maneuvering. Promises, much more room. And you have room twice. One, you have room in deciding, is it a breach? And if so, is it only a little breach? And even if it's a big breach, you get to decide what is an appropriate remedy. Not, hey, blow the whistle, everything's off, nobody has to do anything, which is the effect of an express condition not being satisfied. Instead, you get to say, well, let's see, shall we apply a rule of expectation based upon the cost of completion, or is this a better case because there's economic waste, so we should apply a diminished value rule? Flexibility of that is simply not available. So the court says, okay, this is not an express condition. And they even quote the restatement first language saying, if the words are doubtful, then treat them as condition. The current language of the restatement, which is 228, is very complicated in its formulation, but amounts to pretty much the same thing. Okay, let's turn to one of my favorite Posner decisions. Here we go again, Judge Posner, Seventh Circuit, 1983. And although the style of the case is more in Building Products versus Baystone, who's the actual defendant? For whom is the building being built?
GM,
General Motors, right? So this is a General Motors facility. Their contractor is Baystone Construction, Inc. Morin is the subcontractor, and they've been subcontracted to put up the exterior metal walls. So the facts of the case aren't very complicated. GM is unhappy with the appearance of the walls, or at least that's what they say they are. And so not only do they refuse to pay, they actually tear the walls down and put up new walls. They hire somebody else to replace the walls. Then they're happy with it. So the lawsuit here is being brought by Morin. And what does Morin want?
The rest of its money.
Yeah, they want to be paid. They want the contract price. Their view is, we did what we were supposed to do under the contract, and we haven't been paid the entire contract price. That's what you owe us. And General Motors, or its general contractor, is saying, help. No, and what's their theory for it? No.
They weren't satisfied.
Well, in what language did they, I mean, this is going to be a contract question, right? The question of interpretation of the language. What was the language of the contract in which they were relying?
He said it was all work was subject to final approval, and that the work had to be of first class. And they also mentioned something about what is customary doesn't apply. So they were basically saying what's used in the trade, they didn't want to apply it to this contract. So basically GM had to approve the work before they got paid.
Okay. And they refused to approve the work. Okay. So this is a question that we've looked at a little bit before. And that is, well, satisfied. What does that mean? And you remember that we looked at conditions of satisfaction, again, when we were talking about consideration. And the question was, well, if I have a contract in which I say, well, I'm only going to pay you for it if I'm satisfied with it. Is that an illusory promise? Is it one that's not supported by consideration? Because after all I have to say is I'm not satisfied and I have no obligations. So have I really advanced any consideration in support of whatever your promise was to do if I say I'll only pay you if I'm satisfied with whatever that is? And you remember that the court said, well, look, it's got to be one of two things. Either it has to be objective satisfaction, that is, would a reasonable person be satisfied? It could mean that, and if it means that, that's still consideration. And now we just have to find out whether or not a reasonable person would have been satisfied. Or if it doesn't mean that, then it could mean subjectively, in certain cases, well, if you're really subjectively not satisfied, but there's still a limitation. And what's the limitation? Good faith. The limitation is good faith, our old friend good faith. If you're subjectively, if the proper interpretation of the word satisfaction is subjective, then at the very least you could say yes, true, subjective, but it really has to be in good faith. You can't be saying it just to avoid the contract. That would be bad faith. So we talked about it in the context of consideration, but now we see, we stop and think about this, that this is really a condition. On condition that I am satisfied, I will pay. If I am satisfied, I will pay. If I'm not satisfied, I won't pay. That is an express condition. And so this court is saying, General Motors is saying, hey, you know, this is an artistic issue. And when it comes to artistic issues, the courts say that the proper measure here is, am I subjectively satisfied? That is, am I in good, dissatisfied? Am I in good faith in saying I'm not satisfied? And that's the standard you should use. Morin would prefer arguing the opposite, of course. Morin would prefer saying, all right, there is a condition of satisfaction, but, you know, these are walls of a factory, of an industrial plant. This is subject to an objective judgment. Let's call in other experts, other architects, superintendents of the works, people who are accustomed to building factories, and let's let them say, have we done a satisfactory job or not? That's what it means. So on one level, this is simply an argument about whether or not there's a condition of satisfaction, whether or not this is to be objectively determined or subjectively. Now the interesting thing about this case is that how was it tried? On what basis was this thing tried in the trial court, district court? How did the trial court judge treat this? Is it a jury case? And if so, what was the jury asked to decide? What happened to this case? It found for Moran, and what was the instruction that the trial court gave the jury?
That GM's approval was needed, notwithstanding the apparent finality of foregoing language, general rule applying to satisfaction in case of contracts for construction of commercial buildings. Satisfaction is determined by the objective standard.
All right, by objective criteria. So they were using that interpretation, which I said was the alternative interpretation, the one that Moran would prefer, that this is to be decided by objective criteria. And that was the instruction of the jury. And what did the jury do? Yeah, it was satisfied. They said, okay, the condition was satisfied. That a reasonable person would have been satisfied. And therefore, Moran wins. What happened in front? What did Posner do? Is it the same? After you read all of what Posner had to say about it, do we say, well, there are a couple of possibilities. He clearly didn't say that General Motors had a subjective right, that it wasn't a question of good faith, although he suggested if it was, he thought they were in bad faith. I just want to point out that the jury didn't say that. That's what Judge Posner said. So he didn't say that. Did he say what the trial court judge had said? That is, that this is a commercial building. As a commercial building, it should be subject to that understanding of the word satisfaction, which says it has an objective meaning. And therefore, we refer to whether or not a reasonable person with skill in the trade would have been satisfied. And if so, then the condition's been satisfied. That's what the trial court judge said. And the jury under that instruction said, yeah, we think that it was satisfactory, and therefore Moran wins. What I want to know is that what Posner says?
I would say that Posner, he was definitely upholding the case because he didn't think the trial judge's instruction was clearly erroneous. But I think if Posner had given the instruction, he might have said that let the jury decide whether to apply a reasonable person standard or a good faith standard based on.
Would he? That's interesting. You think that he thought that this language admitted of the possibility of a subjective interpretation?
Well, he believed that it's dependent on what the language implies. So this seems to me that would be a question.
Well, wait a second. What does he do about that language when he talks about the words of satisfaction and the words artistic effect and first class? What does he say about all those words?
Didn't he say something that they seem to be a part of a form contract and didn't really apply here?
Yeah, he said, these are just part of form contract. They don't have anything to do with this building at all. They were just pulled from other agreements. Why does he do that? Well, he's got to get rid of the words artistic effect, because those are kind of magic words too. Artistic effect was designed to invoke the rules with respect to aesthetic judgments. Those rules are subjective determination of good faith, not objective determination of good faith. Now, Posner's not really worried about it because he says, but they could have decided they were in bad faith, but you know something? That would have required a new trial. Because the appellate court can't decide whether or not General Motors was or was not in good faith. We've seen that again and again. Those good faith cases, they almost always are cases that are sent back to a jury. And the jury was not asked that question by this judge. Why not? Because the judge's interpretation of the agreement was that it was an appropriate agreement to be determined by objectively. I have this to ask about Posner's opinion. Let's suppose, I'll leave it with General Motors, okay, so I'm not going to say this was somebody who built Posner's house, although I'm going to come to that one. Let's suppose that this was an office building for the president of General Motors, and it included a big space for the meeting of the board of General Motors. And they used the same contract, referenced artistic effect, referenced the work being first class. Would Posner have decided it differently? How much of this comes from a kind of, I was going to use the word snobbish, that's very unfair, I know. A kind of a prejudice with respect to, a negative prejudice, a bias with respect to factory buildings. You get that feeling as you read this opinion, it always gives me a little bit of the willies. You know, I think about all of these factories that are now built in near residential areas, you know, where they're kind of industrial parks, but they're near residential areas, and they're all built to look more or less like the architectural style of the homes that are in the area. I mean, there's kind of a snobbish, it's just a factory. Or worse yet, think about the gall. If they wanted a uniform finish, he says, what does he say to do?
Paint it.
Come on now. You're a federal court judge. If they wanted a uniform finish, paint it. What, you can't have a natural finish? I mean, how inappropriate is this? I mean, I wonder. If you're a judge, don't do this. This is really unnecessary, isn't it? The oddity about this opinion, as a matter of judicial craftsmanship, is that all he really had to say is, reviewing this agreement, we think that the trial court was correct in its direction, that this is the kind of condition of satisfaction which warrants treating as satisfied if it's objectively satisfied and not subjectively satisfied. All he had to do. He could have written this in a page. It could have been a per cur opinion. But instead, he's left us in doubt. I think there's some language in here which may be designed to suggest that there's no condition at all. That's what I think. That by the time he finishes taking away, the question is, what's left? But in fairness to him, he does sort of at the end say, okay, but even if the trial court was wrong, nevertheless, the result is right because they were in bad faith, which is, again, something I don't think he should have done, because I don't think there was any particular evidence that they were in bad faith. And indeed, it's pretty harsh when you think what General Motors did. This was not a case in which they kind of left the siding there and then said, but we're not going to pay you because we don't like your work. They took it down, which means the result of this opinion is they have to pay for it twice. And as a shareholder in General Motors, because we're all shareholders in General Motors now, I resent it. It is a little strange. There was something going on here, and I don't know what. At the very least, I can understand his saying it warranted an objective judgment. Because in general, the courts more and more use objective judgment in conditions of satisfaction. And only if it's really, 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 really clear that it was subjective, like somebody painting your portrait or taking a portrait of you. Only if it's really very personal do they allow the use of a subjective measure and then measure it by good faith, bad faith. And they could have said that, and I would have been perfectly content. It's not the result that I think is troublesome. I just don't understand what he thought he was about in the process of judicial reasoning. Okay, we will, any questions you have, please either ask them by email or the forum or bring them up at the beginning of class. Otherwise, we're going to talk about the, I think, more complex material in the next chapter, sometimes called the law of implied conditions.